you are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
You are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
To Treasury Cast, the show that celebrates the greatest comics format of all time, the Treasury Edition, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and joining me is our pal, Zoom Yukinori. Hello, Zoom.
Hello, Mr. Kelly. Pleasure to be here.
Great to have you here. Now, you are kind of our resident Dick Tracy expert in that when we did Dick Tracy for Film and Water, you were the guest on that one because you're a big fan of Dick Tracy. And we're here to talk about Limited Collector's Edition number C40, which was Dick Tracy, DC Comics' one and only attempt at doing a Dick Tracy comic book. And I think I probably say this on almost every episode of Treasury Cast, but this is one of my all-time favorite Treasuries. I would put this on top five, maybe even top three. I had it as a kid. I loved it to pieces. I read it 1,000 times. It's probably my introduction to the character. And I had no idea at the time that he wasn't a comic book character. I think I, you know, was like, okay, I guess there's Dick Tracy comic books. I didn't really think about it. But, I mean, I absolutely love this book, and I'm really excited to talk about it. So, Zoom, like, before we get into it, like, are you, I guess you're a big Dick Tracy fan. Did you have this one as a kid, this particular book?
I did. I got it, let's see, I guess it was shortly after it came out. My uncle actually got it for me, and this is the same Uncle Kenzo that actually got me a lot of those Dick Tracy monthlies back in the day. They were basically the comic books that were published by Dell Comics and then later Harvey Comics.
Right.
As I mentioned in the film In Water, basically my Uncle Kenzo was collecting comics before World War II, and then he lost all of those along with his other possessions and his family and their possessions too, because of the Japanese American internment that was happening. So, you know, he had Action Comics number one.
Oh.
He had Detective Comics 27.
Oh.
He had Flash Comics number one.
Wow. He was real. He was in on the ground floor a lot of these things.
Yeah. Emphasis was on had. So, you know, after the war, he would hold on to those comics he purchased, and a few friends of his and other neighbors knew this. So when they were getting rid of their comics, instead of just throwing them away, they would actually give them to my uncle. So he'd end up having a number of duplicates of certain comics, and a lot of them were these Dick Tracy Comics monthlies, and he passed them on to me.
And you took to Dick Tracy, like, in particular?
Oh, yeah. I just loved it. It was law-abiding Dick Tracy. You know, he's the hard-nosed cop, the ultimate good guy that just won't be bought. And it was just a bunch of crazy characters in every storyline, you know, including Flat Top that we're going to be talking about. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the measles, Breathless Mahoney, Heels, Beals, Spinner Record, all of those, you know. It was really bizarre. It was kind of realistic, but kind of fantasy at the same time. So, you know, it wasn't really depicting real life, but it was also promoting Law and Order, which is very good. Yeah, I had a near run of when my uncle gave them to me, it was almost a complete run from issue number 20 all the way to about 130.
Holy jeez, that's a lot of comics.
Yeah, they were published between 1950 and 1959, and in fact, this story that's in the Treasury is also in the these books. And so getting this story again in a different format actually turned out to be a good thing, and we can go into that a little bit later when we talk about the differences between that comic, the comics from Harvey, back in the 50s to this Treasury published in the 70s.
Yeah, this is this book stands unique in that this was the one time DC did a Dick Tracy comic book. I didn't know that as a kid. It would have not even occurred to me. Many years later, when I wrote an article about this very book for Back Issue, I reached out to Bob Rozakis, DC's answer man, because the editor for this one was the legendary E. Nelson Bridwell, who was no longer with us. But I wanted to find out, like, how did this even come about? Because it's just so odd that DC did one Dick Tracy comic and then never did it again. And Rozakis was not 100% sure of the details, but basically he said that, for what he understood, then DC President Sol Harrison picked up the rights to do a Dick Tracy comic book for basically nothing. And he just figured, let's try it. You know, let's just try it, and if it's a hit, we can do more. And unfortunately, this book was not a hit. It basically was a giant flop in terms of sales, so they never did it again. So this was the one moment that DC did Dick Tracy. And it's sort of funny to me that Dick Tracy stands alongside James Bond as the other big cult character from pop culture that DC published one time and never did it again. Because DC did that in the 60s with their Dr. No adaptation, and they never did another James Bond comic. So it's like Dick Tracy and James Bond are just these two incredibly famous characters that were never done again by DC Comics. And, you know, if you're a fan of Batman, I think you're going to be a fan of Dick Tracy because the setup is so similar. You know, this hard-nosed detective, ultimately pure faces, is, you know, fighting crime in this giant metropolis versus this weird group of odd villains. And Dick Tracy actually predates Batman by 8 years. So you have to assume that when Bob Kane and Bill Finger were working on Batman, that Dick Tracy was an inspiration, especially when you're talking about the villains.
And
on
yes.
Yeah, and on the cover of this book, it's kind of funny because the cover for this comic, which was on sale September 4th, 1975, it makes it seem like you're going to see Dick Tracy facing off all these villains because it says, the world's most famous detective fights his most fearsome foes, Brain, Prune Face, Bribery, Shaky, Brow, Johnny Scorn, Flat Top, and Pouch. And none of these characters, except for Flat Top, actually appear in this story. This is really one collected story. But if you from the cover, you're like, oh, this is going to be awesome. This is going to be like a, you know, greatest hits of Dick Tracy, and it ends up not being that.
Yes, but you know the comic strip stories, they're not short.
No.
I mean, it actually came from the comic strip, and the comic book stories were actually reprinting the comic strip stories. I mean, this story that's in the Treasury took about 2.5 issues of the Harvey comic.
That's a lot.
And that's more pages than your typical limited collector's edition book. So it would, you know, it would stand to reason that they only have time for one story, which was edited, of course.
Right. Yeah, the continuity that they're reprinting here are from Dick Tracy from December 21st, 1943 through May 17th, 1944. So you're talking, you know, almost 6 months or 5 months of continuity. On the inside cover, there is a little history of Dick Tracy starting in 1931, going all the way up to 1954. I'm not sure why it stops there, but I guess they maybe ran in a room, and it kind of just gives you some some big moments. Dick Tracy getting married, Dick Tracy meeting Flat Top versus the Mole. Dick Tracy gets married. There's some of his villains. So it just gives you a little bit of a primer of some of the stuff of Dick Tracy, and in black and white, it talks about Bonnie Braids being born, Dick Tracy's daughter. So, I mean, if you're unfamiliar with the character, this is just a nice little greatest hits.
Yeah, and I was wondering, you know, were you pretty much a Dick Tracy neophyte when you got this Treasury?
Absolutely. I'm pretty sure this was the first time I ever heard of it. Because I had this comic when it came out, much like you. So if it was 1975, I would have been 4 or 5 years old. I mean, these things stayed on sale for a long time. From my memory, the newsstands that I bought them from just left them on sale until they sold. They didn't, they were there for like literally almost years. And so if my father or my mom bought me this, if they didn't buy it for me in 1975, it would have been 76, 77. I was still only 5 or 6, and I wasn't really reading the Sunday comics at that point. So, this probably would have been the first time I'd ever heard of any of these characters.
Yeah, I was 12.
Yeah, I mean this was brand new.
But the thing is, I was reading all of those Dick Tracy comic books, so I was able to follow this timeline. you know, the way, they're just pulling things out of context and just kind of slapping them on there with some description and some not. And I was just curious if you were able to kind of follow that timeline as someone that was completely unfamiliar with Dick Tracy.
I just accepted it. You know what I mean? When I was a kid, like when Vitamin Flintheart shows up, it's a character that we already kind of know, you know, the readers already know. Mm-hmm. But I just, you know, when you're a kid, you just kind of roll with it. You know, you don't need everything explained. It's ironically enough, if you would think as a kid, you maybe need more things explained, but you kind of don't. You just accept it. You know, you're just like, all right, these are the characters. This is the setup. The opening page was put together new for the book.
Yes.
And it has Dick Tracy ducking into his two-way wrist radio when it says, during World War II, there were shortages of food, gasoline, and other commodities. Strict rationing was put into effect. But some criminals obtained these scarce items, often by theft, and sold them into the black markets to those who were able to pay the high prices asked, people who didn't ask questions as long as they could get what they wanted. Dick Tracy was hot on the trail of a major black market ring. Afraid of being caught by the law, the gang leaders imported a trigger man to dispose of Tracy, the hitman known as Flat Top. This is the story of what happened when the great detective came up against the most memorable and deadly foe. And then, you know, we'll get into the story. Now, it's funny, from this book, because Flat Top is the villain of this entire story, I always regarded Flat Top as, like, Dick Tracy's number one foe. Which isn't strictly true, but I always sort of thought of him as like he's the Dick Tracy Joker, like he's Dick Tracy's number one foe. But that's really not true. He, as we'll find out in this story, he faced Dick Tracy basically, just one time, right? Because
that is true. You know, but yeah. As I mentioned also in the film and water, he has a son called Flat Top Jr.
Yeah,
and he's got a whole family, and in fact, his father's named Pop Top, and I am not making that up. Honest.
Some woman thought Flat Top, with his literal little flat head and unibrow, was somehow appropriate enough to procreate with. I don't know who that poor woman was. but yeah, I mean, so like in the movie, when Flat Top is in the movie, he is dispatched fairly easily, and he's just a hired goon of Big Boy Caprice. And so I was like, oh, all right. By then, I was more familiar with Dick Tracy, and I realized that he was just one of many, many villains. But for years, I always regarded Flat Top as, you know, the main guy, and it isn't really true. And it's kind of amazing that, considering that this material was bought, as Rosacka said, on the cheap, you know, they had to do a lot of work to make this fit. There's a lot of changes, and we'll get into that in a bit, but it's kind of amazing that how much of a paste-up job this book probably had to be for some DC staffer.
Oh, yeah, indeed. But before we get into that, if you don't mind, just the fact that this is the story that DC wanted to run with first for Dick Tracy, what's very interesting is that when Harvey Comics took over the Dick Tracy comic book from Dell, this was also the first story that they ran with. And it wasn't because it was chronologically after the last story that Dell did. Dell was kind of going all over the map in terms of pulling stories out. So it's very interesting that that DC and Harvey decided to go with the very first story, the Flat Top story. So there must be something about Flat Top that just is visually interesting to just want to go with that story first.
That's interesting. Yeah,
I would have been curious to find out why they picked this story out of all the stories, unless it was just the one that was available.
Could be. Yeah, I mean, like I said, Rosakis didn't actually work on this book, so he doesn't know. I would have loved to, of course, talk to E. Nelson Bridwell, because it's like, you know, they got the rights. Well, did they get the rights for just this story? Did they get the rights for, you know, 5 years of Dick Tracy, and they picked out what they thought was best? I don't know. It would have been interesting to find out what the deal was. But I'm a nerd for that kind of stuff. I love reading about the contracts and what they had the rights to do and all stuff like that. I just nerd out on things like that. But
We do now. I don't know if we did when we were kids when we first had these.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Now I'm all interested in it. But so I'm not going to get into the gritty details of this entire story, because a lot happens. This is definitely an action-packed story. So I'm going to do just kind of a brief overview of it. And the story begins right before Christmas with Dick Tracy happy that for once, it seems like he'll be able to enjoy the holiday season with his family and not have to be out on the streets stopping crime. But it doesn't take long, page 2 in fact, before he runs across the dead-eyed Flat Top, who takes Tracy hostage in the back of a cab at gunpoint. Over the course of 60 pages, Flattop's hasty decision draws in dozens of innocent and not so innocent people, including some black marketeers, a pickpocket, a street corner salesman who meets a bad end, plus the old ham and former big-time movie star Vitamin Flintheart. Hardly a master criminal, Flattop gets through life being more ruthless than anyone else, basically stumbling from one tense situation to the next with Dick Tracy on his tail. And no spoilers, but this story ends with Flattop trying to get away from Dick Tracy by swimming through some pylons underwater where he is trapped and he dies. This story ends with a giant close-up of Flattop's bloated corpse. Which was kind of startling for a kid to read because none of the Batman stories ever ended like that. I had no real idea, as I said, about Dick Tracy. Dick Tracy's pretty violent for what's supposed to be kids' entertainment. There's some pretty gruesome stuff that happens here.
Yes, there is. But, you know, the thing about the violence, I knew you were going to bring this up. I actually had something prepared. Interestingly enough, yes, there are violent and gruesome things that do happen, and but I never believed that Chester Gould's Dick Tracy strip was really celebrating gratuitous violence, so to speak.
Right, right.
You know, his strip was more promoting law and order more than anything else, and it had some moral storytelling in there, and you'll see a little bit of that in this story here and there, especially when Dick Tracy is talking to Junior. Most of the violence is either committed by bad people to essentially illustrate how bad people are.
Right.
Or they're committed to bad people, basically to accentuate the fact that if you're a bad person, you can expect bad things to happen to you. In fact, a lot of the violence that even Dick Tracy inflicts is when he's defending himself. There's a point where Flattop is about to kill Tracy with a gun, and he is manages to wrestle with Flattop, and he's using Flattop's gun to take out the other guys in the room before they could, you know, shoot him. But again, you know, I don't think it's meant to inspire violence at all. I mean, I don't know how detailed you want to go, but there's that scene that you mentioned in the film In Water, where basically a prison guard gets shot with a shard of glass,
right,
in the eye.
Right.
And that strip goes into detailed steps of how to create that slingshot out of a hot water bottle and a shoelace. I mean, basically Flattop is telling you everything as he's doing it. But I don't recall any kids actually imitating those actions, or at least not the glass shard part. I'm sure they were making their own slingshots.
Yeah, I mean, right. I mean, clearly by the fact that all the villains are these grotesque looking monsters, well, Dick Tracy's kind of weird looking too when you think about it, but you just kind of get used to the style. But yeah, no, I agree entirely that this is a very law and order. I mean, Chester Gould was a big kind of like FOP, you know. I mean, he was that kind of guy, very believing in law and order. And I think as he got older, he kind of became a little more kind of arch conservative as the America learned, you know, the 60s changed and there were the hippies, and he was kind of, as far as I know about him, very dismissive of that whole thing and stuff like that. But yeah, I don't believe for a moment that this was meant to make kids get violent. I mean, a lot of stuff that goes on is crazy. I mean, like, there's page 12 is when Flattop is about to rub Dick Tracy out. Finally, Dick Tracy is kidnapped, and he uses he plays the piano and he beats out this pattern with his foot on the floor, which is a Morse code, which is expressing help. And so it's Flattop's about to shoot him, and then Dick Tracy jumps at Flattop. Flattop misses, shoots one of his fellow black marketeers in the face, and where the guy gets a bullet right in the skull.
Yes.
I love that when they're wrestling, another guy is about to shoot, and Flattop's like, "Hold your fire, man, you may hit me." So they're wrestling
back
and forth with the gun. Dick Tracy grabs a machine gun and just shoots a guy in the face. And there's a big close-up of the guy going, "Why, you dirty copper?" Ugh! And you see that he takes at least three or four bullets right to the face. And it's just – that's just not something that happened in Batman comic. Flattop is running away on a fire escape, and a cop gets below him. And Flattop shoots him. He says, "I always carry a spare in my overcoat." And you literally see the bullet go through the guy's body. And you're just like, wow, you know, it's just some amazing, amazing stuff. We just weren't used to that. And then later on, in the next page, Flattop gets away on the subway car. A guy tries to pickpocket him. And
right.
Flattop, it's kind of funny the way Chester Gould draws. Everybody looks grotesque because I guess this is supposed to be kind of a kid.
Yeah, I was wondering about this.
Flat calls him kid, but he looks like a jockey. I mean, he looks like an old dude. He's just like a little tiny guy.
But yeah, I know. One of the biggest questions I had was basically just how old was this kid? I mean, you see him smoking cigars.
Right.
A little bit later, he's buying knives and betting tickets. I mean, right. You know, the betting age was 21 in the early 1930s. So it's like, you know, they keep calling him kid. And there's this scene a little bit later with the ice skates. And I feel like I'm going into too deep of detail there, but the part where he's skating on the ice and they keep interjecting back and forth with Dick Tracy and Junior, and Dick Tracy is giving Junior advice about, you know, easy money is not good for a kid. And then we find out what happens to this kid because of the easy money he got from Flat Top.
Right.
And it gave me the impression that these kids are supposed to be the same age. Just from that, but you look at the kid and it's like, no, I mean, he does look like he's 50 some years old.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And in terms of, you were talking about like the morality of this, when the jockey, or I keep calling him, he's not a jockey, but when the kid, let's call him the kid, takes money from Flat Top and he's got his money and he's looking at the ice skates. All of a sudden you've got a narrator popping in, where he says, watch out for those skates, bud. They'll be your downfall. So you've got this omniscient voice of God telling the kid, you know, be careful, be careful. And the kid buys the skates with the money. And it's, you know, clearly you're not supposed to benefit from the bad money you've gotten from the bad man. You know, I mean.
Right, exactly.
We're going to repair what happens to you. There later on, there's a sequence where, and this is something I learned as a kid, where like you could do this, where Flat Top has to hide something, and he cuts pages out of a book,
a scrapbook,
and he literally cuts the pages and turns it into like a little. I never knew that was a thing. You know what I mean? Like somebody would do that, because he has to hide the stolen loot, and he does it by placing it in the book. And like that was a new thing for me when I was a kid. I was like, it never occurred to me that you could cut pages out of cut the center out of a book, but leave the book, you know, kind of intact from the spine. And hide things in there. Like, that was a whole new concept for me.
So how many books did you cut up in your home?
I never did. I never had a knife sharp enough to do it, but I love the idea of it. It's just fascinating.
Well, I'm sure you have a sharp enough knife now, sir.
Well, that's true. Yeah, I should do that, yeah. And then later on is a sequence where Flat Top is trying to evade Dick Tracy, and he hides in a chimney, and he gets stuck. And that always kind of freaked me out a little. And he gets stung by a bunch of bees, because there's all these bees in there. And he gets discovered by a chimney sweep who pokes him in the head.
He didn't get discovered by. Is that what happened in the book? I better double check that, because I guess they took that part out.
Oh really? Okay, because it's here in the.
Oh no, they didn't. They didn't on page 26. It took me a while to get there, but.
Okay.
But basically,
because he's not a chimney sweep. Yeah.
Because, well, what's funny is that there's a beehive in there, and he's disturbing it, and he's causing the honey to spill out, and the honey is spilling out in one of these rooms in the building, and they're actually like tasting the honey out of the stovepipe hole that's coming out, and they're like, oh, there's honey. There's honey in the chimney. So he actually goes up to the chimney to get the honey out, to get the beehive out, and he accidentally pokes Flat Top.
Right.
As a result.
With the broomstick, yeah.
So this is almost like the challenge of the Super Friends thing you were saying before, where things just happen because they have to happen.
Right, right, right. One of the things that I appreciated, and it took me a while when I was like, quote unquote, an adult and read this more, is like Flat Top is not a particularly good villain. He's just ruthless. You know, I mean, he's not particularly crafty. He constantly getting himself in these scrapes, and he just is able to shoot his way out of things or kill his way out of things. And that's how he gets out of these situations. It's not because he's smarter than anybody else. He's just more vicious.
And he seems to have a bit of luck for a bad guy, too.
Right. I mean, later on, he meets this salesman, the street corner salesman.
Oh,
and,
yes.
And the guy says, he finally realizes, he's like, hey, I know you. I remembered. I've seen your face in the papers. You're Flat Top. And he's like, shut your trap, guy. And then he ends up shooting the guy. Now, they have a little bit of a kind of a cliffhanger here because he shoots the guy, but we don't see him do it. It's we see it from the outside. We just hear see the word balloons. And then we see what we think is Flat Top falling to the ground. And we see what we think is the street corner salesman pouring gasoline.
Hawker Davis. His name is Hawker Davis.
Hawker Davis. Pouring.
What a nice name.
Yeah, really. Pouring this fluid, this flammable fluid, on the corpse and setting it on fire, which is, again, another brutal, moment. And they find the corpse, and everybody thinks that that's Flat Top's corpse because it's...
Well, even the reader does, too. And there's that omniscient narrator again that says, well, this is a surprising turn of events.
Yeah, right, yeah.
because we're reading, as you're reading the strip, you're thinking, oh, this Hawker guy just got the better of Flat Top. He knocked him out, and then he sets him on fire. And it's like, what? Because you don't see their faces. You only see their clothes.
Right, and then everybody thinks Flat Top is gone. We're like, oh, that's a weird thing. And that's kind of the middle of the story, and that's where they do the cliffhanger, because then we have one of the little – another bonus features from this treasury is this two-page spread. DC loved doing these center spreads of Dick Tracy's rogues gallery, and we have something like about 15 or 20 of his most famous villains, and there's these little profiles. And, I mean, just – I love looking at these things because it's just such a great – history of Dick Tracy. And when I was a kid, some of these characters are just bewildering to me because you're like how do some of these people work? Like Spots. He's got
Spots is so funny.
He has no eyes, and he has just spots that float around his head. I couldn't understand it.
Well, that's like Spots before your eyes, all you see are the spots. Mm-hmm. And yeah, he has no eyes on his face at all. That's part of the fantasy element. And the interesting thing is that when he meets his untimely end, those spots just kind of float away and pop like little bubbles, and they're gone.
That's weird.
And he still has no eyes on his face.
Bizarre. Oh my God.
It was really bizarre. It was a very bizarre yet very clever visual cue, in my opinion.
Oh, he was visually – Justin Gould was second to none. I love that there's Pruneface and Mrs. Pruneface.
Yes, of course.
Pruneface found love. That's even someone who looks like Pruneface. That's wonderful.
Well, she looks a little bit more like the Grim Reaper, really.
Yeah, she doesn't look like him exactly. Yeah. Shaky, BBI, Stooge, Viller, Mumbles, Flat Top, Steve the Tramp, who of course was in the movie. I mean, you see, a lot of these characters were worked into the movie. Bart the Brow, 88 Keys. The Dick Tracy movie did quite a decent job of getting a lot of these people in, but I love these little profiles. This was, again, I didn't heard of any of these characters, but I was really intrigued by them because they're visually quite fascinating. I mean, they're all grotesque and just weird, strange looking people, but I love.
Yeah, even Breathless Mahoney is too. So.
Yeah, right. Even there isn't anybody here that you could sort of classically. I guess the closest is like Stooge Viller. I guess he just kind of looks like a regular person, but everybody else is weird in their own weird way. And of course, you got Mumbles, who was played so great in the movie by Dustin Hoffman and stuff. So
yeah, I know they should do a Dick Tracy sequel that just says, "Let's get ready to mumble."
How long were you waiting to use that? So
2 weeks, sir.
2 weeks. All right. Fair enough. So
that's when I came up with it.
Okay. So the story resumes, and Flat Top runs across Vitamin Flintheart, who is this kind of old-timey – I said we learned that Flat Top is not dead. Flat Top has switched coats, and that's how we realized that Flat Top didn't die. It's the other guy that died at Flat Top. And so everyone for a while thinks Flat Top is dead, and he assumes a disguise, and he goes on, and he continues his crime ways until eventually he reveals himself through Vitamin Flintheart that he is, in fact, still alive.
I love Vitamin Flintheart. He is your stereotypical melodramatic actor that's always an actor,
mm-hmm.
always on stage all the time. So when you're speaking to people or just ordering a drink from the bar, he is doing it in that overly melodramatic way.
Yeah, I assume he's kind of like a Douglas Fairbanks. He's like an old silent star, and he's used to being the center of attention and stuff like that. And he's kind of he's not a bad guy. Like he's just kind of oblivious because he doesn't realize that Flat Top's a bad guy. He takes Flat Top at his word. Flat Top uses him to hide the gun in his pocket at one point.
Yeah, exactly. Well, actually, he doesn't hide the gun. Well, what funny thing is that the police actually use Vitamin Flintheart to identify Flat Top because he helped disguise him. And Flat Top was kind of doing this tale of woe, going, "Oh, look at you! You're handsome, but I'm all ugly and stuff." You know, and that kind of goads a Vitamin to say, "Oh, well, I've got a makeup kit here. Let me show you how good you can look with all this," and changes his complete appearance, not realizing that was the plan. And then he knocked Vitamin Flintheart out and left. I think the only reason he didn't kill Vitamin Flintheart was he was the only one that said, "I know you. You're Flat Top."
Right, yeah.
He's the only one that didn't do that.
You're right about that. He doesn't hide. They hand Vitamin Flintheart the gun, and Flintheart puts it in his pocket. That's right, I forgot.
Yeah, and then the police forget about it, and Vitamin Flintheart forgets about it, and it ends up leading to an accidental shooting of a bartender.
Right, right.
Which leads Vitamin Flintheart to go to prison. It's the same prison as Flat Top, which Flat Top uses Vitamin Flintheart to escape prison. Again, these things are happening because they happen. And of course, because Vitamin Flintheart is smoking or throwing vitamin bottles away as they're escaping, these become trails of clues that lead Dick Tracy eventually to where Flat Top is hiding.
That's right.
I'm probably giving away too much of the story. My apologies.
Wow. I don't think anybody's going to trick this out and read it based on our opinion, but that's fine.
Hey, you listeners, all you people out there in podcast listening land, you should read this story.
You absolutely should.
It goes through so many twists and turns, and there's so many different characters that just kind of step in and out, you know, like the kid pickpocket we talked about and Vitamin Flintheart. And then there's Margie, the girl that's practicing to be the Women's Army Corps, which is what inspired Dick Tracy to tap out the Morse code that we were talking about, because he knew that she would be able to pick up on it while Flat Top and his cronies would not. You know, it's just brilliant how he's able to incorporate all these different characters in there, and they don't feel like they're just taking up space. You know, they all serve a purpose, and they're all interestingly enough that, you know, when you look at the whole thing, you're like, my goodness, this would never make a very cohesive movie or anything, or a cohesive book by any means, but it's just a fun ride all the way through.
Yeah, I agree. The characters sort of wander in and then they wander out. I mean, I love in the outside the movie theater, when Flat Top's hiding in the movie theater, they square off with Dick Tracy. Dick Tracy shoots Flat Top in the chin, mm-hmm. and you see the bullet go into his face, and later they're wrestling Flat Top in the ambulance, and Flat Top's face is just bleeding uncontrollably. Well, Dick Tracy's like, "Lie down, Flat Top." And all he can see that is, I think, of Steve Buscemi in Fargo when he gets his cheek shot by the guy and he's just, the blood is pouring out. I mean, again, it's just like, it's such a weird idea that this is aimed at kids, you know, that this is like aimed at children to entertain.
Well, to be honest, you know, this was during the 40s. This was in, let's see, going back to the first page again, this was 43 to 44, yeah. So, you know, most of the comic strips in the newspapers were targeting, I mean, they just target kids back then. They targeted adults. They targeted everybody. They weren't expecting kids to, you know, read the comic strips or buy a paper for the comic strips. So a lot of the comic strips had a lot of adult entertainment. I don't think a lot of kids really wanted to read about Rex Morgan, M.D.,
probably not.
Or the other soap opera type of things like Sally Forth and others, but Modesty Blaze maybe.
Later on, Flat Top escapes. You mentioned he escapes prison by making a slingshot out of the broken bottle, and a poor guard gets it in the eye. He escapes to this old wooden ship with a Vitamin Flintheart. Dick Tracy and everybody chases him down. I love that throughout the rest of the story, Flat Top has the bandage over his chin. I think that's just like a nice little detail that he doesn't heal in 2 seconds. So then Flat Top realizes Dick Tracy's getting closer. He hides in a rowboat under the boat, and then he starts trying to escape. And they look down and they see that he's crawled in under the water, and he gets caught in these pylons. That the ship is sitting on, and there's this great single panel, which I have used as my Facebook avatar many times, where it says, "Meanwhile, Flat Top has run into difficulty. tragic difficulty. And it's just him struggling to breathe. It's such a brutal end. And then the very next panel is Flat Top caught in this vice, and he's dead. That's it. He's over. Flat Top's, and the only reason they find him is Dick Tracy's foot hits the corpse, which they yes. pull out of the water. It's like, whoa, Dick Tracy does not mess around.
No, that's right. He was kind of diving down, trying to find him, and he just kind of stumbles around. That's just a lot of happenstance there, you know. Yeah. And they actually have a newspaper thing about Flat Top dies, and you know, Vitamin Flintheart's story will continue a little bit through the rest of the issue 27 of my Dick Tracy Comics Monthly, but then it'll segue into another story. They were kind of going in chronological order at that point.
Right. The limited collector edition ends with Flat Top in the morgue, his body on the slab, and it says, you hear Dick Tracy say, "Wire his family, Pat. They may want to claim the body, and then again, they may not." And then we've got a narrator saying, "Thus, we take our last look at Flat Top, the end." And you know, this is really, I've mentioned this in previous episodes of the show, these treasuries were trade paperbacks before there were trade paperbacks. You know, this was collecting a story on between two covers. And this was really way before anybody thought to kind of do stuff like that. And that's one of the things I love about it, is that you obviously see there's a larger Dick Tracy world, but you get a complete story. You know, you get the Flat Top being introduced to Dick Tracy, the whole story, and then Flat Top dies at the end. It's a complete, A, B to C kind of thing. And that's one of the things I loved about it. It feels like you got so much entertainment for a dollar, you know?
Oh, I know. And because of all those twists in the story that we talked about, you know, that part in page 30 and 31 where you think Flat Top had already been killed, and it's like, well, that's the end of Flat Top. Story would end here.
Yep.
Or when Flat Top is captured and goes to prison, you'd think, well, okay, they caught Flat Top. Story ends here. No.
Nope. Yeah.
Nope. There's more.
And there's a couple more special features. There's a Dick Tracy Talks to Uncle Sam feature, yes, where they're talking about the technology and stuff that he's got, which, again, Dick Tracy was always kind of ahead of the game on that stuff, the two-way wrist radio, which we still really don't have. We're getting there, but we're not quite there yet. And then there's a Crime Stoppers textbook, which is these little file cards which show people how to search for clues and stuff. I imagine you didn't – now you. This is original to the Treasury, I think. This is not.
No, actually, these were from the Sunday strips in the 50s and the 60s. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
If you look on page 3 or 6 or 9 of the Treasury, you'll notice that there are these real thin story panels next to the title banner.
Right.
You know, these later became these Crime Stopper handbook notes. That's the location they would be at the top right corner of the strip. And there would be these are just a sample of them. I know they kind of show it here without any context. And if I didn't tell you, you wouldn't have known.
No, I didn't know that. Okay.
So yeah, these are like tips for rookie crime stoppers is how they look. But though I believe the one about having a small hammerless snub-nosed revolver in your pocket being handy, I think it was more of a factoid for about plainclothes. I think that was more of a factoid for plainclothes policemen rather than encouraging would-be crime stoppers to go arm themselves with these things. At least that's my hope.
Hey, kids, a snub-nosed gun really fits well in the back of your shorts. Okay. You say so.
Yeah, but there's that women in an emergency where they talk about how the spiky end of those combs that you keep in your purse could be a good defensive weapon. there were other things like that too. There was like I remember reading one coming across one in an actual comic strip where it was like, you know, if you're on a blind date, before you go on the blind date, be sure to memorize the license plate of the car that you're picked up in, just in case something goes wrong and you have to report it.
Wow, that is good advice.
It is good advice, and it's a lot of these things are very, very helpful.
All right, cool. Keep stay safe, kids.
Yes,
and
that's right.
The inside cover is a biography of Trister Gould, which I assume is written by Nelson Bridwell, since he wrote all these things. So we get into his career, and I mean, at this point, you know, Trister Gould had been doing the strip for 40 years. I don't know whether he had been ghosting it at this point, whether he was still literally doing it or not. He's at the very least, he's getting credit for doing it, or whether he was, you know, just sort of doing the whole, you know, just signing his name to it and having other people do it for him.
But, yeah, to be honest, I honestly don't know. Again, all the reading I was doing about the Dick Tracy strip was mostly the ones that were in the comic books that were the ones that he definitely did do. Though, of course, you know, one could argue whether Chester Gould actually did the artwork in this story, as we'll get to eventually.
Yeah. So then on the back cover, it is Dick Tracy and his friends, and it's Dick Tracy with Chief Patton, Liz, Junior, Diet Smith, B.O. Plenty, Gravel mm-hmm. Gertie, and Sam Ketchum.
Yes.
None of these characters, well, Chief Patton and Sam are in it briefly, but none of these other characters yep. are in this story.
That's right.
Liz and those other, and the only other reference I ever saw to B.O. Plenty was on an episode of MASH, where the whole idea was that, you know, B.O. Plenty was stunk. That was his whole persona.
And yes, that's
there's
right.
There's an episode of MASH where they cook up some medicine that is has healing properties, but apparently it stinks to high heaven, and Hawkeye refers to it as having a stench that B.O. Plenty would find offensive. So
right.
I was like, okay, that was like my one other, like, oh, all right, I know who that is. I know what Hawkeye's talking about. But I mean,
you got to wonder if the studio audience actually got that one, or if they actually just put in a recorded laugh track.
Well, all the MASHes had laugh tracks. So, yes, that was a fake laugh. But, yeah, it was a, you know, for Hawkeye, it was a contemporary reference. But in the 70s, when that episode aired, it must have been like, what the hell does that even mean? But this is, I love this book. I just love
yes.
this book to death. It's just so much fun. And I'm so sorry that DC never did another one, that they couldn't have. I would have loved to have like a Prune Face book and a Brow book and a Mumbles book. Like, this is just, I when I had this one as a kid, I just read it to death. I just loved every, it was so weird, the tone. And, you know, I had no conception that this was comic strip reprints, because it looks like a comic book. It's panels and word balloons. But I couldn't figure out the weird rhythms. You know, the way the story seemed to keep, like, restarting itself over after every page. I just didn't,
yes.
like, I was a kid. I was like, okay, that's just the way the story was told. But this is just so beloved to me. I just love this book so, so much.
Yeah, yeah. You're thinking of maybe page 6, panels 9 and 10.
Right.
Where
right.
basically panel 10 is a recap of the previous thing. So you
yeah.
see, like, Flat Top holding the gun going, you know, put your face to the floor or turn toward the floor or whatever. And then the next panel is I said, do this. So it kind of makes sense. But then, of course, you know, I have to admire that the DC staff decided to really be preserving of the caption box, which basically repeats what we already know. It says,
right.
scene, a dark country road. The cab bearing Dick Tracy and two gunmen stops. But, of course, two panels before we already read, and on a dark gravel side road, well out in the country, stop here, Charlie.
Yeah.
And that was just two panels back, you know, so it's just funny.
Right. I mean, they said they're you know, when you read this in the original format, you were reading it across days. I mean, you know, it's like, I think I once read that, like, how you write an adventure strip at this point, if not that there are very many left, but there are still some, but the idea is that, and this was something that I used in Ace Kilroy when I did my Ace Kilroy webcomic, because that's done as a comic strip, which was basically first panel repeats what happened in the previous strip. Second panel progresses the story. Third panel is the cliffhanger for the next strip. And then you just repeat
right.
the process over and over again. So you really don't get – you have very little real estate to advance the story. But that's how you have to do it. You have to keep people up to date. So
yes.
in terms of, like, the Dick Tracy villains, do you have a particular favorite? If it's not Flat Top, are there other ones that you really liked?
Well, I already mentioned Spots, which I just thought was visually interesting. And I did like Flat Top. Flat Top was and maybe because I see Flat Top Jr. and then Mrs. Flat Top and Flat Top's sister and Flat Top's father, and they all look like Flat Top.
Oh, Lord.
You know, he's kind of like, you know, maybe that's why he is like one of the most recognized and prominent Dick Tracy villains, even though he only literally appears in just this one story. But you keep seeing him later and later and later.
It's interesting that Chester Gould, considering when you do a comic strip, you know, you have to really, you know, it's a beast, you know, it's constantly grabbing content, that Chester Gould was so capricious about killing off his villains. Except that he just was like, all right, let's just kill him off. It's fine.
Right, right. Well, he wanted to basically get the point across that, you know, you do bad things are going to happen to you, as I said earlier. But Mumbles, you were talking about how you saw Flat Top as the Joker, I guess Dick Tracy's Joker. Actually, Mumbles is Dick Tracy's Joker. He is the one that gets killed at the end of the story, but they don't find a body, and then he comes back in a later story. And sometimes they explain how he came back, and sometimes they don't.
Interesting. Okay. It's funny, because in the movie, he's played as a joke character. When Dustin Hoffman, he's just comic relief in that story.
Yes.
Interesting.
Yes, I know. And, of course, Flat Top was relegated to being just a hired thug. Of course, he was kind of a hired thug in this story, too.
Right.
But he's more to it than that.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I really wish DC could have done this again, but, you know, they did it the one time, and they did it right. I mean, they didn't even do it as a single part of the reason DC probably did it as a treasury is because they needed the physical space. They needed the size because, you know, some of these pages have 15 panels, and if you would either have to squeeze it down or you'd have to do like what Harvey did, like you're talking about, or spread it over several comics. And maybe if DC was sort of taking a flyer on this, they didn't want to risk publishing 4 or 5 issues of Dick Tracy in case the first one bombed and then they're going to stuck with it. So it's like, let's just do it as one book and then we'll see what happens. So it made sense to do it in this large format. And I'm so glad they did. I have really still distinctive memories of sitting on the couch up at our cabin in the Poconos and looking at this comic and just, you know, as the sun came in over the window over our couch and just getting lost in this story. I just love it to death.
Yeah, it's always a fun read, and I had fun rereading this too, just for the show as well. And you know, comparing it to my Harvey comics, you know, the panels are just only a tiny bit bigger than how they appear in my Harvey comics. So you know, like you said, putting so many panels on the page, it almost looks like every page is almost like a Sunday strip.
Yeah, yes, it does look like that. Yeah, especially it's got the little header and stuff on it. So it's a great book. I mean, anyone of you who are listening, if you're any remotely a fan of Dick Tracy and you've never picked this up, you can get it relatively cheap. I've had some friends, I think Clinton Robison from Coffee and Comics blog sent me a picture that he saw it somewhere for like $10, and it was in good shape, and I'm like, pick that up, man, like that's a good deal. You know, it's because it doesn't have a lot of collector value. Dick Tracy's not like a hot character. It's not like it's some, you know, collection of like Wolverine or Batman or somebody that has a real fandom. So it's absolutely worth it. It's a load of fun. So Zoom, like, thank you so much for coming on to talk about this. This was one of my favorites, one of the ones I wanted to get to immediately, and I knew you were a big Dick Tracy fan. So now we have covered two different Dick Tracys over two different podcasts. So I guess we'll have to find some third, do a hat trick and do a Dick Tracy thing there.
Yeah, hopefully there is something we can do. Did Bob Dylan do a song about Dick Tracy yet?
I don't know. I'll have to look. I don't believe so, but I'll look it up. You never know about him.
Samantha Fox almost became Breathless Mahoney on the Dick Tracy movie. Maybe we can tie that in, and we can put Zoom Love Sam on the network.
All right. So before we wrap up here, I did want to ask you. Like, you're talking about these Harvey editions that you had, and there were some like pretty big differences. Can you go over a little bit about some of those?
Oh, sure. Yes. Well, the first one is basically, and this is the benefit of the treasury, I actually get to see the beginning of the story, because in the Dick Tracy Comics Monthly issues 25 through 27 is where this story takes place, and 25 is right when Harvey took over doing the Dick Tracy in the comic book format. And they basically start their story at page 6, panel 2 of the Treasury. So I missed the whole thing about Flat Top arriving in town, which was actually the last panel of the December 21st, 1943 strip, because that's supposed to lead into the next story. And the whole bit where the taxi cab and how they trick Tracy and threaten to shoot him and all that's gone. He's already at Flat Top's area. Flat Top already asked for more money. So, you know, just like how the Treasury had that recap at the beginning, which is basically telling everybody that this is taking place in World War II, there's this black market thing going on, and Tracy's after these black market people. And so they hire Flat Top, you know, to set the stage. My book basically has this big newspaper headline that just says, "Extra, killers nab Dick Tracy. Dick Tracy, on the verge of exposing the illegal activities of an underworld gang, has been shanghaied by a professional gunman, Flat Top, who was hired for $5,000 to kill Tracy. Realizing that he has the upper hand, the ruthless killer is holding Tracy captive while he demands more money." It's almost like the Star Wars title crawl. It's awesome. It sets the stage. So, you know, I didn't realize that there was more to the story until I got the Treasury. So it was wonderful. I got to see what I missed, which was good. And we talked about how there are these repeating panels, the recap panels and such. The Treasury actually dropped a number of them, while the Harvey comics kept a lot of them. Most of them, I mean, some of them are slightly different, but they still kind of repeat what happened. But others, because they place them in such a way that, you know, this is the last panel of page 3, and then you flip to page 4, and then the first panel, it kind of worked. For example, that last panel on page 9 of the Treasury, where you see Dick Tracy stomping the Morse code through the ceiling to Margie, who is the woman that is... that we happen to know through the course of the story is practicing using the telegraph so that she can join the Women's Army Corps, so that she picks up on it. I mean, the first panel in the panel that you see in the Treasury is, oh, that piano player, is he trying to run his foot right through the floor? But in the next strip, that panel is redrawn almost exactly, and the dialogue now says, why does that person playing the piano upstairs have to stomp so hard? Wait, what's that? You know, because this is the panel that was dropped, but it's the one that established that Margie was recognizing the foot stomping patterns as Morse code. And of course, what's actually brilliant from an artistic point of view is that the foot stomp effects on page 9 and 10 of the Treasury actually resemble dots and dashes. And in the original story that I have from Harvey, you could actually see that the Morse code was spilling out D-I-C-K-T-R-A. So it was very, very cool. Unfortunately, in this book, well, you know, they were... A number of the panels had to be redrawn, and everything was relettered as well. It makes me wonder about the original condition of the artwork that was provided to DC, to be honest, because I can show a comparison of the panel I just described of Margie being annoyed by the foot stomping through the ceiling. You can see that... in the Treasury, it looks a whole lot more simplified, almost like somebody, maybe one of the DC staffers, they had to redraw it, possibly. I don't know.
We'll show that. We'll put this in the gallery post on the website, because I like to show everybody this. This is neat stuff.
Yeah, and the other interesting thing is because they redrew it and they relettered it, they did the Morse code wrong.
Ah.
So one of the Morse codes, it spells out S-C-K-T-R-A. So I guess it's Sick Tracy now. I don't know.
See, yeah, it's a lot of work, you know, for this book.
Oh, yeah. And just going back to the story, I love that inventive way that Dick Tracy and later Patton actually employed the use of Morse code to send messages to each other without Flat Top and his gang noticing. I mean, we talked about the foot stomping, but later on the next page in the Treasury, page 11, Patton is actually using a light bulb to create radio interference when he heard that the radio was on in Flat Top's apartment upstairs. So he's like twisting the bulb to create these clicking noises and on the radio, and Dick Tracy is picking up on it. In fact, you get that little lightning bolt message caption going into his head, talking Patton speaking, you know, sit tight, help on the way type of thing, which is really, it's a very Dick Tracy type of thing that's really cool. But I digress.
Clever guy, that Dick Tracy.
Yes, indeed. But anyway, while they did redo all the dialogue, they kept the original dialogue, or I'm sorry, they relettered everything, but they kept the original dialogue intact, which I gotta admire that they did that.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess putting the setup at the beginning that it takes place in World War II and all of this, so they didn't have to like change aspects of the story to fit the times, like the cost of ice skates and things like that, you know, because, wow, only $20 for a pair of ice skates? That's cool, you know, that type of thing. Yeah, exactly. But, you know, I of course, I'm comparing these to my Harvey comics. I'm not comparing them to the original strips from 1943 and 1944. And, you know, I don't have those. I don't have the complete Dick Tracy comic strip books that were published by IDW. One day I will put enough money aside to be able to pick those up, because I would love to have those.
Yeah, those are beautiful books. Those are really beautiful. They do such the IDW does such a nice job on them. I love that they are formatted to look to be like the newspaper strips, that they're oblong books. They don't try and force the strips into a more sort of quote unquote marketable size. I think they're right. Really beautiful. They're really gorgeous.
Yeah. And then you can find all the panels that they took out.
Yeah,
of the treasury.
Exactly.
But, you know, even though they did take those out, and I know the Harvey comic took some things out too, because I actually see some panels in the treasury that are not in my Harvey comic stories. Usually they're those thin panels up by the title head, the title masthead of Dick Tracy. None of those panels are in the Harvey comics, because they're just so thin, they don't fit. And they're mostly recap panels anyway, so they can drop them. And of course, dropping the panels, when the Treasury dropped some panels, it didn't really impact the flow of the story. I think you were still able to follow the story along, even though some of those details that were missed would have been really nice to have.
Yeah. I mean, the Treasury as it stands is very focused. I mean, it's just flat top.
Oh, I was just saying, you know, if the cover didn't lie, and it was just, you know, Dick Tracy faces Flat Top, plus find more information about his, you know, fantastic foes or whatever it is, fearsome foes. Maybe that would have sold the book more. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe so. Yeah, I don't know. It's a shame. I get the feeling it was just probably just too old school for what kids wanted to read in 1975. But, you know, I mean,
yeah.
I think the strip was kind of not particularly, you know, popular by 1975. It languished for a long time. Now it's kind of really back, thanks to Joe Staton. The great Joe Staton is the artist on it, and, you know, he's meeting the spirits, and they're doing all these cool things with it, because it's kind of got this retro cool appeal. But I think probably in the 70s it was a little slow, rough sledding, as it were. So DC probably didn't have best time in the world. Their timing with James Bond was bad too, so they seem to have this kind of a knack for not getting the properties at the exact moment.
Yeah, and you know, I think, again, when they redrew the panels, they did such a slipshod job of it. And if you show if you see the comparisons, even though it was drawn in the 1940s, I think the style really holds up and held up for something in the 70s compared to some other, like, mm-hmm. Golden Age reprints that they were doing at the time.
Oh, yeah.
Which also makes me wonder if a lot of those Golden Age reprints were just retouched up by DC staffers at the time that didn't really give much care to it. But anyway, I seem to remember some other times when DC was reprinting Golden Age stories, they would actually redraw the stories. There was like a Golden Age Flash one that they didn't use the original art, and they actually had some kind of caption at the beginning saying, well, the original art just doesn't hold up to today's standards, so we hired this artist to redraw it, or something like that.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. I think it was the DC Superstars that featured the Flash. I think it was issue 5.
Oh, I'm going to have to track that down. That sounds really fascinating. Yeah. I never knew they went that far with it. Wow.
Yeah, and I understand there were a few other stories that were like that too. I'll have to but that's the one that really sticks out in my mind. But anyway, I'm digressing, sir. But that pretty much, you know, compares that's pretty much my comparison of how it compares to the Harvey comics.
That's cool. All right. Well, before we wrap up here, I have to ask you, Zoom, the questionnaire that I ask everybody when they're doing the show for the first time. And those are the two Treasury questions. First question is, what Treasury should DC have done, or not DC, anybody? I keep saying DC, but it should be anybody. Do you think should have done? And I always take Wonder Woman off the table, because to me that's the obvious answer. But is there one character or one feature that you think DC, or again, I keep saying DC, DC or Marvel or anybody should have done? And then the other question I ask you is, what Treasury would you like to see done today? Completely not worried about any financial concerns or whether it would sell. What feature would you love to see in that format right now?
Okay, well, since the answer to both of those questions would be the same, I'm going to put Wonder Woman back on the table and say that was what they should have done. They should have done a Wonder Woman Treasury. I remember they did this Wonder Woman Spectacular book in like 77 or 78. It was one of those DC special series. I think a book, a story like that would have been a wonderful Treasury edition.
They could have done
the Flash Spectacular also in that Treasury format. Because it was a very big story. It was an all new story, and it had all three Flashes. So that was another one they should have done. So I guess we could have kept Wonder Woman off the table. So I apologize. Now, if it were up to me, I would have created a Green Lantern Treasury, and it would be reprints that delved into the origins of Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern mythos, with reprints of the following stories. One would be the Planet of Doomed Men, from Green Lantern Volume 2, Issue 1, and that briefly retold Hal Jordan's origin from the Showcase issue and also introduced the Guardians of the Universe. And then there was Earth's First Green Lantern. That was from Green Lantern Volume 2, Issue 16, and that actually was the first time they explained why Abin Sur, who was capable of flying through space solely with just the Power Ring alone, why he was in a spaceship when he crash-landed on Earth. And then we can throw in the origin of Green Lantern's Oath, just for fun. That was from Green Lantern Volume 2, Issue 10. And it explained that Hal Jordan was actually the one that came up with that rhyming, solemn oath that he uses when he charges his Power Ring. And he quickly highlighted three short adventures that actually inspired the lines in Brightest Day, In Blackest Night, and No Evil Shall Escape My Sight. And then, of course, rounding out the treasury would be a reprint of The Secret Origin of the Guardians from Green Lantern Volume 2, Issue 40. This introduced Krona and explained how he first unleashed evil in the universe by conducting this forbidden experiment, which was then picked up by Marv Wolfman, using it as the explanation of how the multiverse was created in Crisis on Infinite Earths. And that's what skyrocketed the cost of the book in back issue stores from that point on. And of course, that story also guest starred Alan Scott from the Earth 2 Green Lantern at the time, because he teams up with Hal to stop Krona from basically finishing his experiment that would essentially destroy the universe. So this was actually the first crisis of the universe.
Wow, cool. That's a good collection. Yeah, it is amazing to me that Wonder Woman didn't get a treasury, considering she was on TV. Right when the treasuries were at their peak, that seemed to be like a no-brainer to put, you know, as seen on TV. That's kind of amazing to me that Wonder Woman never got. It wasn't like they didn't have the material.
No, that's true. But you know, a lot of the Wonder Woman, you know, after, in my opinion, I guess, I think after the original creator William Moulton Marston stopped doing Wonder Woman, I think a lot of people, I think DC didn't know what to do with the property, but they knew they had to do something.
Right.
Or else they would lose the rights to the property, and they didn't want to do that. So they basically printed Wonder Woman because they had to, and
right.
because it was something that they had to do instead of wanting to do, there just wasn't so much enthusiasm about it. And even with the television show, I suspect that the DC editorial staff and just the creative people in DC at the time still saw Wonder Woman as something they had to do,
yeah.
Which is unfortunate.
Yeah. That's too bad. Well, now they're learning, you know, now they're learning. I mm-hmm. made up a mock Wonder Woman treasury with your help, because you sent me,
yes.
you were kind enough to send me a nice high-res scans of the custom Who's Who listing that you did for the sort of Earth One Wonder Woman of the sort of mid-70s Wonder Woman. And I made that into a custom treasury cover, which I put out on Twitter on the Treasury Comics Twitter feed. And I every so often I will at DC Comics and say, DC, not too late to make this, put it out, you know.
That's right.
And they missed the movie, but now maybe they could, you know, and they're probably going to miss the home entertainment release. But, you know, Wonder Woman 2 is just a couple of years from now. So I hope they pick up the slack. Because now that Marvel's doing treasuries again, and digests, I'm hoping that DC gets back in on it. So
yeah, and I was very honored that you used my artwork to create that, and I followed up with creating the 3D diorama back cover for you.
Did. It's gorgeous.
They need to bring those back.
Oh yeah, oh, God, people need to cut up their comics again. Yeah, for anyone who anyone who hasn't seen Zoom's custom Who's Who listings, go to the website fireandwaterpodcast.com and check out the Who's Who show pages, and you'll see some of the custom ones that Zoom did. It's just gorgeous stuff. It's so letter perfect. It's just like, oh man, I wish we could just, you know, kickstart this and do a whole separate Who's Who book. But we could go on and on about this stuff. So Zoom, thank you so much for coming on to talk about this book. This was one of the ones that, like, it was my love of this book that made me kind of want to start this show in the first place. And so I'm so happy I got a chance to talk about it. So thank you for coming on. And where can people find you on the internet?
Well, thank you for having me, sir. And yes, I'll keep it brief. I created a blog site called Omelette au Fromage, which can be found at zoom-yukinori.blogspot.com. I basically designed that blog to help people who don't know me to get to know me and to help people who do know me to get to know me better. Sometimes there's an entry on comic books and animation, but they're more the exception than the rule. I also make regular artistic contributions to The Line It Is Drawn, which is a weekly sketch challenge found on Fridays on the Comic Book Resources website. That's at cbr.com. And finally, I've been honored to have a few FW Presents podcasts available on the Fire and Water podcast network. One is on the amazing world of DC Comics, and the other is a fan panel discussion on Batman the Animated Series. And of course, I'm only also hard at work on my first season of the Done in One Wonders podcast Wonder Show, which will spotlight my favorite Done in One comic book stories, and it should debut in late August, early September on the Fire and Water podcast network.
Very exciting. We're very happy to have you as part of the network, and just the handful of shows you've done by yourself and the guest appearances have been terrific, so we're all really, really happy to have you aboard, and I can't wait to hear the Done in One show. That's going to be super fun.
I am hoping so, sir. That's what I'm aiming for. Thank you.
All right. So thanks, everyone, for listening. Of course, you can find back episodes of this show on our network site, fireandwaterpodcast.com, and you can follow the Twitter feed, which is at Treasury Comics over on Twitter. So everybody stay tuned through these podcast promos, and when we come back, I'm going to do some listener feedback.
Dudes, it's totally time to listen to Fan Holes.
What's that, Mikey?
Like only the most tubular, righteous, gnarly podcast ever.
I don't know, Mikey. I've got some science projects to work on.
Yeah, Mikey, and you know, some of the things those fan holes say, you know, really ticks me off.
Well, why don't we see what Master Splinter has to say about listening to fan holes?
Yeah, sure. Okay, Leo. But what do you think, Master Splinter? Should we listen to Fan Holes, the pop culture podcast made for fans by the fans, or not? I say, go, Fan Holes, go, Fan Holes, go! Ha 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 ha! I made another funny! Ha 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 ha!
Dude! Turtle Power Podcast Hour!
A podcast crossover event featuring Fan Holes Podcast, Bored with Friends, and Animated Indulgence, coming this September.
Coming to media players everywhere in 2017 from the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Beginning with the origin of his comic book fandom and ending with the destruction of the universe, Professor Zoom Yukinori leads a monthly expedition through his favorite single-issue comic book stories from the Bronze Age of DC Comics. While promising unique celebrity guest perspectives in an ambitious attempt to set this program apart from other comic book review podcasts, thrill to the imagination, bask in the brilliance, experience the wonder of Show me the wonder I've seen the birthplace of the universe. The Done in One Wonders Podcast Wonder Show. Discover how compressed storytelling can broaden one's mind. Listen for it wherever Fire and Water Podcast Network podcasts are networking.
It's time for some listener feedback, and let's start with a new iTunes review. We have a iTunes review from Harry in Chicago. He says, I was a kid in the 1970s and cherished Treasury Comics. I recently discovered this podcast, and I'm enjoying listening to their recaps and the commentaries. Listening to the podcast conjures up 40-year-old memories. Lots of fun. Thank you very much from Harry in Chicago. We really appreciate the iTunes reviews. Now let's move on to the commentary that we have on our website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com. First up is Edo Bosnar, who says, I may have said it before, but Treasury Cast is definitely my favorite show on the network. And I'll say that until your next Digest Cast drops, at which point I found myself thinking, that's my favorite show on the network, and then another Treasury Cast will appear. And so we swing back and forth between your most gigantic and minuscule shows, so to speak. Anyway, love the show. I have fond memories of the movie, as it is one of the first serious movies, i.e. non-Disney, PG-rated, I went to see without parental supervision. My older sister, who had just gotten her driver's license that year, took my brother and me to see it. That's a great memory. That's very cool. Seeing Close Encounters of the Third Kind when it's like one of the first movies you see by yourself, that's a big deal. Thank you, Ada. Paul Hicks from the Waiting for Doom podcast says, this was like a bonus Film and Water episode. Great chat with Chris. Thank you, Paul. Chris Franklin from our network says, great episode. I appreciate Chris hammering home Dreyfuss's character being a deadbeat dad and husband and leaving his family like this. It's always bothered me since the first time I watched Close Encounters on TV in the early 80s. I had no idea Spielberg had similar thoughts in hindsight. But no, I don't want him to fix the movie. No more walkie-talkies for guns like in E.T. Speaking of which, I think this movie sometimes feels like the forgotten Spielberg blockbuster. I know it's not really forgotten, but it's not mentioned as often as say, Jaws or E.T. And there is little to no merchandise out there for it, so it loses a bit of ground in nerddom because of it. I've never read this adaptation, and I didn't know it was by Simonson and Goodwin. The art shown here is, of course, outstanding. Sounds like this would be a nice comic book to reprint in a new Treasury, maybe by IDW? Good idea, Chris. Siskoid, also from our network, says, I agree with Chris's initial assessment that it's better not to know what happens after the end of the theatrical cut, and so there should be no sequel in comics or otherwise. Then again, if it were something completely crazy like Jack Kirby's 2001, and how strange to see Simonson's work without John Workman's trademark sound effects. Thank you, Siskoid. Ange from Comic Book's commentary says, love this movie and this comic, although long lost. As I said in Film and Water, I saw this in the theater with my father and found it fascinating. I don't know if I quite understood it all back then, but who doesn't know those five notes means hello? Simonson is incredible. Thor, Dr. Fate, Close Encounters, everything. True enough, Ange. I can't think of a single art job by Walt Simonson that I didn't think was fantastic. And finally, Brian Linton says, thanks, gentlemen. For the longest time, as kids measure time, I was afraid to watch Close Encounters, but I loved it when I finally did see it. Out of all the amazing scenes in this film, my brothers and I got the biggest kick out of the Square song that, I believe, plays when Barry's toys are going crazy. As an aside, I have a theory that this scene inspired the Toy Story franchise. Anyway, it's great to see that Marvel produced such a beautiful, treasure-sized adaptation of the movie. Yes, it sure is, Brian, and I wish, now that Marvel's doing treasures again, maybe they would do movie adaptations again. I hoped that they would maybe do something for Force Awakens. That obviously didn't happen. I haven't heard anything about The Last Jedi, so it seems like they're just not going to be doing any sort of treasury books for the Star Wars titles, which is too bad, because those Star Wars treasuries were amazing things, and so I liked all these movie adaptations that Marvel used to do. Anyway, thanks everybody for the comments. Really appreciate it. And let's move on to Twitter, where we got retweets and likes from Supermates Pod, Comics in the GA, Rolled Spine, Kyle Betting Art, Rad Adventures, Multiverse HQ, Extreme Black Cat, Comic Reflection, Hassan T16, Chris Ryall, thank you, Chris, Max O'Romero, 13th Dimension, Chuck Rod 75, Ryan Daly 01, Army of Womack, Garage U1, Coffee Comics Blog, Stuart Conover, Lacey Field 9, Toy Lab HQ, Jim Cripps, Real Ignacio Rayo, 90Z69, Beyond the Geek, Haven or Fantasy, Carl George 2099, Coffee Steve, Abel Padzilla, Krypton Kylie, Mike Comics, Daniel Burway, John D. Null, BTO and Bat Books, David Tipton, and Nelson Daniel. So thanks, everyone. Thank you, Harry in Chicago, for the feedback. I really appreciate it. Really, of course, appreciate Chris Ryall coming on to talk about Close Encounters. And I appreciate our pal Zoom Yukinori, part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, coming on to talk about Dick Tracy. That's one of my favorite books, and I had a lot of fun discussing it with him. That's such a great comic. So, and of course, you can check out images from the Dick Tracy comic on our website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com. Just check out the accompanying gallery post to the post for this episode. So, again, thanks everyone for listening. Thanks for all the comments, all the feedback. It's really, truly appreciated. So, I guess until the next episode, go big or go home.
Dick Tracy, he's a good cop.
Dick Tracy, he's a good cop.
Tracy, he's a good cop.